Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. On this week's show, Adam Boileau and I will be talking through all the week's security news, and then we're going to revisit last week's Shadow Brokers theory. Was Joshua Schulte the evil genius mastermind behind the Shadow Brokers, as well as, allegedly, Vault 7? Well, probably not. But yikes, that is a whole big rabbit hole, and we'll be talking about all of that, talking more on that at the tail end of this week's news segment. This week's show is brought to you by Corelight. Corelight's Richard Baitlick joins us in this week's sponsor interview to talk a bit about how they're trying to build up the open source community behind Zeek, on which Corelight's products are based. We'll also have a bit of a chat about the concept of network security monitoring as ground truth. That is a theme that's popped up in a bunch of interviews lately. That's good stuff, and it's coming up after the week's news discussion with Adam Boileau, which starts now. And Adam, indictments.
Yes, the US have rolled out another round of indictments, this time against some gentlemen from the Chinese Ministry of State Security or some affiliated group that are the people who took out Equifax. Yes, does look like that has been, you know, fairly, I mean, well, I guess we kind of had an idea that it was, you know, that it was Chinese state sponsored. But I mean, when the US are at the point of like putting mugshots on the screen of various people, and some of those mugshots do look rather suspiciously like they were taken out of the, you know, the webcam.
Yeah, they sure do. Right. I was going to say that, like, what's really funny about those mugshots, one is definitely from a government ID. Cause you know, you can see where it's laminated. One of them looks, yeah, like they popped some dude's laptop and took a nice little picture of him through his webcam. Another one is like just a military like photo, but the, there's one which is, you know, the one who had the good OPSEC because they don't have the photo.
Yeah. Congrats to that guy. You did well. Good. Well,
yeah. Yeah. So we've dropped a link into some reporting from Wired on that, plus the actual indictment on the justice.gov website, and you can have a look at that. Dustin Volz from the Wall Street Journal actually had an interesting comment, though. He said that during the DOJ press conference, the US Attorney General linked the Marriott breach to the Chinese as well, and I think it looks like they're moving towards more indictments. You know, maybe focusing on that breach. We've also got reporting out of ZDNet here saying that the FBI is investigating more than 1,000 cases of Chinese theft of US technology. And yeah, there's more indictments coming down the line. It looks like they're really ramping this up. I don't know how much good it's going to do, but, you know, they're doing it.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like they are starting to really pull this stuff together. And we've seen like kind of dribs and drabs of attribution and, you know, them using the naming and shaming in the public arena as a tool. But I mean, if they're kind of foreshadowing there being 1,000 investigations underway and, you know, tying together a bunch of these operations to kind of build a bigger picture of, you know, what Chinese activity looks like, you know, in terms of the espionage side of it, in terms of the industrial espionage side of it, and then the kind of the bigger picture of, you know, stealing data from the personnel management and from Anthem and from, I guess, the Marriott, you know, and Equifax, like, you know, building a picture of all of that activity and then being able to, you know, make it look more, you know, look at it more holistically and be able to say, you know, we're making these indictments for this individual case, but it's kind of part of a bigger campaign, and that's almost more important than the individual, you know, the individuals in this particular one, for example. Because then realistically, unless they decide to go, you know, take a holiday in Mexico or somewhere, they're probably not going to get, you know, actually, you know, end up in American clink.
No, but I think you're right. I think this is about, you know, turning it into a big picture where you've actually got some at least alleged facts, right, in charge sheets and indictments. And then, you know, there's some political stuff that flows from that, right, where all of a sudden US leaders can point to these indictments and say, come on, guys, you know, what are you doing? Knock it off.
Yeah, and I mean, you can use it once it's in the public record and kind of out like this, then you can start to use it in other fields, right? You can start to use it to encourage other organizations to take things more seriously. You know, I'm sure with all of the palaver we're going to talk about, you know, about the election security side of things, like this is kind of sets up a bigger picture that you can then use to advance the other goals, whether or not those goals are, you know, are good. I mean, obviously the amount of intellectual property theft and the impact that that has on research and dev and all that kind of thing, like those are important. Using it for some of the other, you know, trade war purposes, maybe less so, but it does start to give them, you know, something to kind of anchor all of that on when you've got this kind of body of work, prosecutions and investigations and all that to draw on.
Meanwhile, the Malaysian CERT has pointed to a bunch of hacks, and they're saying that was, they're pointing the finger at APT 40 on that, a Chinese APT crew. So yeah, lots of stuff going on. Now, this next little batch of stories, my God, I mean, I even sent you a message yesterday, right, about this. The thing is, right, I like to be the reasonable person on this show who just says, you know, like computers, the internet got us a long way. You know, computers are good. The internet is good. And then just you have a week where you just think, my God, we're all ruined. We're all ruined. And the world is held together by matchsticks and sticky tape. And this is one of those weeks because, geez, I mean, just walk us through the next few stories that we're talking about here, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, I'm normally the doom and gloom one, and unsurprisingly, I'm still the doom and gloom one. this particular story is about a mobile app that was built by the ruling Israeli political party to kind of support their electioneering. They get as part of the process over there, you know, a copy of kind of voter registration database and things that they can use for targeting, individual people and supporting the whole, you know, electioneering process. Someone went and had a rummage around in this particular mobile app. Turns out they don't have any authentication on their API endpoints, and you can just kind of like
get dash admin dash users your way to victory. Yeah.
So you can just like pull the admin users out, and then that had the like clear text creds for the admin users, and then you just got to log into the rest of the app and off you go. Which, like, that's a significant, you know, what, like 6.5 million Israelis personal details. And I mean, this is, you know, quite detailed personal information that they get for election purposes. It's just, I mean, unfortunately, you know, this stuff is built on the cheap, you know, by, you know, not very highly paid people for very little money, and you end up with stuff that, you know, just because it looks fine to, like, the end user, like the people who are, signing off the app, who are doing the user, looking at the user interface designs and then testing it to make sure that it meets their requirements. Like, they don't understand any of the underneath gubbins, and you end up with apps that are, you know, kind of UI mock-ups almost that are just production, because people don't understand the difference between a production app and a thing that just looks like it works. And
I was contacted by a listener about this one as well, and, you know, obviously I can't confirm what they told me, but they told me that after the initial round of reporting on this, they actually found like another related endpoint that was like a config endpoint for this app, which leaked S3 keys, which happened to get you into their entire AWS environment because they hadn't restricted the keys at all. Do you know what I mean? So this is just like, by the looks of things, I mean, even if that part isn't true, it's just a disaster. And this comes, of course, hot on the heels of the Iowa thing, right? And last week we were just like, well, you know, whatever, an app fell over. But then, you know, people have actually had a look at the app since then, and geez, man, what a disaster. What a piece of shit app, honestly.
I think it was a Motherboard that got hold of a copy of the app and managed to send it off to Veracode to have them, you know, run through some, you know, look at how the code was built and how the app was built. A bunch of people had a look at it. And so the app was built on top of the React Native framework, which is, you know, kind of cross-platform app dev thing. It uses, you know, a bunch of web tech, JavaScript and whatever. Anyway, by looking at the app and the way it's built, it really does look like someone took the, you know, basic template app and then, you know, kind of copy-pasted their way from Stack Exchange and Stack Overflow to build themselves a really basic app. And it has, you know, very, very straightforward kind of features, is poorly kind of built. And you know, some of the people who've looked at it said, like, this looks like it was written by someone for whom it was their first time building this sort of thing. And unfortunately, you know what, I 100% believe it. Because when you look at how much money they spent on it, which was in the order of, what, like $60,000 or something, like, for that much money, with all of the people taking their cart and all of the other bits involved, like, you really don't get much in terms of time and attention and expertise. And, you know, in the end, this is where we're at, right? We've got an entire technological system where people don't understand how it works, and therefore they can't judge the quality of the systems that they're procuring or they're buying or they're causing to be built. And we end up with, you know, tens of thousands of, you know, interns and noobs who've never had enough experience to really build something sufficient to use in an election, you know, copy-pasting their way to victory.
I mean, attention, Americans, right? You've got healthcare.gov, which came in at a cost to taxpayers of $11 gazillion, right? And then you've got this, which was $60,000. You got to find the sweet spot somewhere in between those two figures. Apparently, the Nevada caucus was going to use an app from the same mob, and they, you know, cancelled last minute. Apparently, no surprises there. But the other thing too, like another thing that may have delayed results in the Iowa caucus was the fact that 4chaners were jamming the telephone lines that they were supposed to use for their fallback process, right? So as much as I was hoping there wasn't going to be a security aspect or a security angle to this, there actually is. Kill me.
God, yeah. And it's, I mean, it kind of underscores the sort of, you know, collapse of decency in the modern democratic process, you know, when you've got, you know, the political parties are already at each other's throats, and then the, you know, and all the political tools are being used. But then we've got, you know, 4chaners and trolls and jerks and one kind of struggles to understand whether or not they're actually genuinely, like, you know, Trump supporters or actually have some political agenda.
Or they just want to piss in the punch, right?
Exactly, right? Yeah. And, you know, they've got the you know, tools, but in this case a phone and a message board and some anonymity to go and just troll for the sake of trolling, which, I mean, there's always been that kind of being a jerk. It's just you can do it at such scale and with such kind of network effect now that you couldn't, you know, when you and I were probably dumb teenagers doing dumb things.
Lily Hay Newman for Wired reports that Google is now giving away its Titan security keys and, you know, advanced protection accounts to people running for office, which seems like a very, very good move.
Yeah, they've teamed up with this organization called Defending Digital Campaigns, which, you know, are providing security advice for people who are running for office and for campaign organizations and all of the other kind of various bits of the political kind of grassroots in the US. And obviously Google, you know, is very big in the email space, and them chipping in with hardware tokens and, you know, their existing kind of services for high value targets is a really useful thing. You really got a question though, whether, I mean, the kind of the root cause problem is that these organizations that are, you know, spring up to run campaigns, to run for office, are inherently kind of temporal, right? They're not long-running organizations with lots of the same sort of people, lots of the same hardware. You know, the incentive to build, you know, long-term, robust, secure infrastructure for these organizations doesn't really exist because they're so ephemeral. And it does make me wonder whether, you know, throwing a few security keys at it, I mean, it's probably better than nothing. And obviously some security advice or whatever, but it's just like the structural aspects of it really do make it very, very difficult to come up with something that's actually going to be robust. So, I mean, really good start. Good job, Google. Good job, the people involved. But
see, this is the whole thing. This is why I sent you that message yesterday, which was an audio message for listeners wondering, where I'm just like, my God, man, you know, everything's ruined. Because, you know, you just look at the number of stories sort of affecting civil society this week, and it's just, you know, you just look at it and you think, how can I fix that? Well, I mean, luckily for Americans, the Government Accountability Office is onto it. They have a scapegoat here. It's Caesar's fault, basically, according to a GAO report.
Yes, apparently, according to them, the Department of Homeland Security's Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, which is tasked with, amongst other things, defending the elections from hackers, apparently they've only done half of the things that they probably ought to have done to protect the elections, and I question whether or not, you know, it was a feasible task to set them in the first place. But yeah, they got a whole bunch on their plate, and the GAO is concerned that they don't have a whole bunch of concrete plans for what to do when things go horribly wrong. Obviously, you know, Caesar hasn't been sitting around doing absolutely nothing. There's been a bunch.
They've been working very hard, right? And you look at the stuff that Caesar is doing, and it's all the sensible stuff, right? So you just sort of wonder if this is GAO sort of going. I think there's a sense of that this year, isn't there? And we've spoken about this in other episodes of, like, serious people high up in the power structure sort of looking at the problems we've got and just demanding someone, anyone, fix them, right?
Yes, and I mean, there's a, you know, obviously along with that process comes a bit of ass covering, right? Making sure that there is a report somewhere that says, hey, you know, somebody else didn't do their job to prepare right, and, you know, that's unfortunately, part of the bureaucratic process. But yeah, I mean, certainly the, you know, when you look at the amount of work that Caesar has done in, you know, trying to cover off such a disparate and kind of, you know, non-homogenous set of organizations, that some of whom don't even want the help, right? I mean, we saw some reporting about the, you know, the Iowa caucus app, you know, where it had been offered, you know, where it was offered to them to review it, and they didn't take them up on it because, I mean, you know, presumably for a project that small, it wasn't worth the overhead of even answering the email or whatever the, you know, whatever the impediment was. So you do see them really, you know, kind of trying, doing a bunch of work, you know, helping out. But it's just such a big, sprawling problem with history going back for so long.
It is. And meanwhile, Bob Lord, the DNC CISO, is probably sitting back reading this report going, sweet, off the hook. But that's the thing, right? Dear. Like, it is such a big problem. See, I think 2016 was the year of the wake-up call, right? 2016 was the year of the wake-up call where powerful people realized, oh my God, okay, we've got a problem here. And I think 2020 is the year where they realize there's no easy solutions. And I think we're starting to see that. I mean, do you know what I mean, right? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, this, you know, because it's such a, you know, interwoven in so many aspects of society, and we're starting to see the impact of that now. Whereas, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, you know, nerds kind of dealt with this stuff, right? And we're starting to realize this isn't a nerd problem, right? This is a structural problem that we happen to have a whole bunch of nerds involved in. Those nerds are not particularly good at what they do.
Now, we got a great yarn here from the Washington Post that does deal with stuff that has previously been reported. In fact, you know, this story was going viral earlier today, and I saw Scott Shane from the New York Times kind of getting a little bit grumpy because he's like, hey, I wrote about this in like 1995. but it's of course dealing with Crypto AG, which for a long time we've known that Crypto AG, you know, cooperated with US intelligence to sort of subvert the equipment that it was selling to various countries. But the big reveal in this story, and of course there was a TV documentary that aired in Switzerland late last year, I believe, that talked about a lot of this stuff. But yeah, Washington Post has a big write-up here, and it's doing the rounds. But the cool thing is, like, and this is amazing, turns out the CIA actually owned Crypto AG, and that is a bit that I wasn't aware of, were you?
I mean, no, I didn't know that. And I mean, even the, I mean, obviously, you know, there was kind of scuttlebutt, everyone, you know, there was some understanding that some of the gear was being...
But I love it that people were actually paying to buy equipment from them that was subverted, right? Like, it's amazing.
But yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed reading the piece, actually, because, I mean, we've seen bits and, you know, snippets of the story before, and you know, it was kind of generally understood, but not specific. And I was really reminded of the, you know, the kind of the way that I felt after the Snowden thing dropped, where there was a whole bunch of capabilities we assumed that the spooks had, and a whole bunch of things they were doing, we kind of assumed that we were going to do, and all of our 90s cypherpunk kind of sensibilities were based on what we imagined that they were doing. And it was very, you know, kind of justifying, like, you felt like, I'm actually not a crazy tinfoil hat wearer because of all these things through the Snowden docs. And I kind of felt like this about the Crypto AG thing, where, you know, we assume crypto gear is backdoored and the algorithms are designed by the NSA, or they're implemented, you know, by the NSA in a way that will allow them to recover keys, and there's lots of shady deals going on. But just seeing it all really laid out made me feel good about being a cypherpunk in the 90s, you know.
It's funny though, because when I was reading this, it just made me think of how, you know, Senatas is a sometime sponsor on Risky Biz. They're based in Melbourne, so I know those guys. And one of the things that they sell is like a, you know, it's all FIPS certified crypto gear, right? You know, with all the tamper proofing and stuff, but they sell them with blank FPGA arrays so that some of their customers can actually put their own algos on it. And you read this story and you're like, gee, okay, rolling your own crypto doesn't sound so insane anymore. And I asked them too once, I'm like, you know, we're always told not to roll your own crypto. And they just said, look, some countries actually have thrown the work at this to do it right, which is, I found that very interesting. That was a couple of years ago we spoke about.
Yeah. And it certainly makes sense in the light of a story like this, but it's, I really enjoyed it because, I mean, the, you know, going through the history of it and looking at the, you know, the original associations and the motivations of the founders of the company and the way that they were, you know, then subsequently propped up by the US and then, you know, eventually bought by, you know, a consortium of the German intelligence and American intelligence operations. And the idea of the, like, the dividends being paid, like, in a suitcase in a parking garage in Berlin was just, you know, it's lovely stuff.
Well, and, you know, given the time period, I wonder what that suitcase full of cash was used to do. Probably not nice stuff, right?
Like, I mean, yeah, and that was the one of the funny bits I found was the, you know, the extent to which the Germans really liked the money and the Americans more worried about the intelligence product. And then the Germans getting huffy when the Americans wanted to sell to everybody, and it was all, it's just a, you know, it's a really lovely insight. And I don't know where all the docs came from. I guess they're, you know, some of those were released as historical archives from the CIA. It's just, it's a lovely insight to all of the, you know, the bureaucratic processes and the back and forth and the effort that they go to, you know, to really Trojan the supply chain for, you know, crypto gear for a significant portion of the world.
Yeah, I just love the tension between the Germans and the Americans is pretty funny, because the Americans were just like, let's sell it to everyone, absolutely everyone. And the Germans are like, wait, what? So just a bit.
And then when the Germans back out of the project and the CIA buys out their share, and then the Germans are like, well, do you think we're still going to get the good gear? It's no, you don't. That's why the NSA is all up in Chancellor Merkel's phone listening to her stuff. But it's, you know, I think it's a mandatory read for anyone, you know, who's interested in this stuff, because it's just such an important part of our history. And then, you know, when the Americans then turn around and point at Huawei and say, hey, you know, you should worry about supply chain security, at least then you know they're coming at it from a position of authority, you know, where they've been doing it 50 years.
Nice segueing there, Guy, because that is indeed our next story, which is a big one dropped today dealing with Huawei, which says that, you know, essentially what it looks like they've done is backdoored the lawful intercept capability on their gear, which is like, you know, I mean, we saw during the Aurora attacks in 2008 that that was the stuff that that China was going after, right? Was the LI stuff, the lawful intercept stuff in Google. And, you know, so this certainly gels with the narrative of what is a priority for China. But, yeah, walk us through this piece.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously we've been asking for a while about some actual details about, you know, what Huawei backdoors look like, you know, actually show us some smoke and guns, because Americans have, you know, spent a lot of time saying to their various Five Eyes allies, you know, you shouldn't use Huawei gear. And, you know, out in the public domain, it would be nice for us to actually see some data. And this is sort of the first, you know, bit that actually points to a specific set of subsystems or whatever, which is, as you say, the lawful intercept. The fact that China has the ability to gain access to the lawful intercept without the cooperation of the wider network or the, you know, the authorities in the country, which, I mean, kind of makes sense, right? They built the gear, they understand how it works. There's always internal kind of plumbing that gets you there. You know, I've hacked a couple of lawful intercept systems in my time, so I, you know, I understand the processes by which you would go through to use them. And yeah, you're also right with the, you know, drawing some of the historical examples of, you know, people breaking into LI gear or people stealing data about LI to be able to use it for their own purposes. I was thinking actually of the classic Vodafone Athens affair, NSA breaking into Vodafone Greece and you know, using the lawful intercept functionality to intercept phone calls, right? It's a natural place to do it because you've got so many of the moving parts already there.
Yeah, I mean, if it's already built, why not use it?
Yeah, right? Why not use it? Exactly. It's the right place to do it. It's got the access you need. You just got to kind of plumb yourself in and out and, you know, the fact
but look, there is a super odd paragraph in this story, and I'm just going to read it. It says, U.S. officials declined to say whether the U.S. has observed Huawei using this access. U.S. officials also haven't provided details about the alleged backdoor access, except to say they have been aware of it since observing it in 2009 in early 4G equipment. Observing what? Like observing, did you observe the back door? Or did you observe the use of it? It's a little bit muddy, right? Like that's a shitty paragraph. I've got
to
be honest.
That is a little bit muddy. And I want to see the logs. You know, I want to see, here's the firmware dump.
PCAPs,
you know,
show us, or it didn't happen.
Yeah, exactly. Show us the, you know, show us the Ghidra disassembly of the bit that implements the backdoor cred, please. I would like to see that. So, you know, if you just go ahead and DM me that, I would love that. Thank you very much.
Yes, excellent, excellent. And, you know, we've got this other story here. This one's from Catalan at ZDNet, where the, you know, the US Attorney General has said the US and its allies should invest in Huawei competitors, which, like, yeah, that's a good idea, but why haven't we been doing that, like, along since, you know, 5 years ago? Who's got a time machine, you know?
Oh, dear, yeah. And, I mean, it's a good idea. And obviously, if you want to go buy some stocks in Ericsson or Nokia, you know, Nokia Networks might be a good time to do so if they're going to get, you know, funded by the US government or
the boondoggling
associates.
Boondoggling intensifies.
Yeah, but of course it's not as simple as that as well, right? I mean in Catalan's piece, right, it says, you know, the Finnish firm Nokia and Swedish firm Ericsson. It's just not that simple, right? I mean, that you know, Finnish firm Nokia is what used to be Siemens, bought back by Nokia. Like, it used to be a joint venture between Nokia and Siemens, bought back by Nokia to keep the name, which then bought Alcatel-Lucent, which bought half of Bell Labs, which is also Nortel, which has some, like, Shanghai Bell in it as well. Like, this is not a, you know, this is not a Finnish company. Sorry, Finland. You know, I know you're very proud of Nokia. But, like, it's just not that simple. And, you know, half the Alcatel gear is Nokia gear is made in China anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know. I'm not sure about Ericsson. I'm less exposed to Ericsson stuff. But, you know, it's just not that simple.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. We're trying to unblend a global supply chain there. And it's
where we're at, right? I mean, we have to, you know, to balkanize a worldwide supply chain made up of all these kind of companies, that's really hard.
Yeah. But look, man, this next story from Brian Krebs, this is your jam. This is totally your jam. Corp.com is going up for sale.
This is a wonderful story, and I
salute. This is like WPAD on steroids, but continue.
So back in the mid-90s, early 90s, this guy Mike O'Connor domain squatted a whole bunch of, you know, really common, you know, really sensible domain names, places like, you know, bar.com, you know, and pub.com, back when, you know, there were four domains, right? I mean, there was .com and .org, and that was about it. So yeah, he squatted on a bunch of these domains, and he's been gradually flogging them off over the years, but the crown jewel for him is corp.com. And he's held on to that to this day. He's now 70-something years old. He's thinking about, you know, some money for his children's retirement, perhaps. Corp was special because in a bunch of Microsoft documentation, when people were first rolling out Active Directory, that was the kind of name they suggested. Now they use Contoso to try and discourage this kind of situation happening. But there's a whole bunch of people where Corp is the name of their domain, their internal Windows Active Directory domain. And as a result, whenever you take a box out onto the internet that was from inside the corporate environment, when it now goes to the DNS using names that aren't fully qualified, it ends up knocking on the door of and authenticating to corp.com, the actual DNS domain. And so people have done some research, in cooperation with the guy who owns this domain, done some research like running up something like Responder or whatever that's kind of capture authentication requests and running a mail server and seeing how much stuff goes in there. And apparently it's something like, you know, hundreds of thousands of boxes just like hosing credentials at corp.com, which, you know, sounds like a wonderful place to be.
You want hashes, dude? You want hashes? I'll get you hashes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could shell so many things from that place. Anyway, he is going to try and sell it. And he wants, like, what, a mil seven, something like that? Yeah. And I guess Microsoft's just going to have to suck it up and buy it. Like, there's just no other... Like, you're just going to have to do it, Microsoft.
I think they are, and I think they should. I mean, if they don't, I think probably an organization like Caesar should probably step up.
Just going to have to pay this guy off. You know, it's the stupidity tax, deal with it, just give the guy his $1 million and, you know, let him dance around.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the way this has got to be, because you don't want the GRU getting this domain, is what I'm getting at.
No, you probably don't. And also, we don't know that this guy's OPSEC is sufficiently good to be holding on to this, like, now that we've publicized it, right?
Well, that's another thing that occurred to me, right? Has he 2FA'd the domain registration, right? Like, how easy would it be to actually just snag this one?
Well, it's a good question, right? It'd be worth it. We worth a hoon.
Yeah. Not that we're planning ideas in anyone's heads, but don't be silly. Moving on, just very quickly, a Brazilian judge has declined to move forward in prosecuting Glenn Greenwald, which, you know, even though he is a 24-carat jerk, is the right call.
Yeah, there was some previous ruling that said that they weren't going to investigate him about, you know, stuff related to the car wash, Operation Car Wash kind of thing. Leaks, in Brazil. Yeah. And the judge has basically said, because of that, we're not going to carry on in this case, but that's not saying anything else. So we may well see some more stuff happen. I mean, you're the Brazil expert on this show, so, you know,
I don't think it's going to happen personally. I mean, you know, the situation in Brazil right now is they have a pretty extreme president with authoritarian leanings. Some people call him Tropical Hitler, right? But the institutions so far seem to be standing up pretty well, right? Because trying to do anything as the president of Brazil is in fact really, really hard. Right? It's just such a hodgepodge political system that, yeah, I think he's a little bit disappointed that he can't be a dictator, but I don't think it's going to happen. So, you know, I still think, though, the biggest risk to Glenn Greenwald is probably people with guns as opposed to the legal system, I think. And I do believe that he actually has armed protection right now, which really does suck, right? Like, it does, that he has to live like that, but it is what it is. Ars Technica just has a little report there, which makes the good point that, you know, focusing on backups in the ransomware crisis isn't going to necessarily get you very far, because these days ransomware crews are stealing data and, you know, that's part of the ransom now. It's not just about locking everything up. It's also about, well, we're going to dump all of your stuff publicly. Staying with ransomware, and Toll Group, which is the Australian logistics firm, very big company, has been dealing with a ransomware outbreak. We sort of predicted that it was going to start to crunch, and it looks like that's starting to happen. They've got a lot of dissatisfied customers, delayed parcels and whatnot. But I'm also seeing elsewhere that it looks like they're starting to get on top of it. So it looks like they might have effectively managed their way through this, muddled their way through, which is more than you can say for a lot of other firms.
Yeah, it does sound like, they're saying that some of their tracking systems and, you know, other interfaces are becoming available again, which obviously implies that the backend systems that support that are also available, presumably authentication, et cetera. So yeah, it does seem, I mean, it's only been, what, a week and a half since they got popped. So that's a pretty reasonable turnaround time if they do manage to pull it back together. But I mean, given the size of the network and the environment, but they're also coming out and saying, well, you know, no personal data was taken. And it's like, well.
Oh, their PR response has just been like embarrassing boilerplate stuff. It's been terrible.
Unfortunately, it has.
But it looks like, you know, not making a big deal out of it, being a small target and just focusing on getting through it. It looks like they might have actually done a bit better than most. God knows how much this is going to cost them to clean up, right? So we'll find out eventually. The Credit Union National Association, which is a lobbyist and trade association for credit unions. They got themselves ransomware. What else have we got? Oh,
that one's primarily funny because they just finished running an exercise for the credit unions that they look after to simulate ransomware.
And then is funny. I didn't catch that in the story. Ars Technica has this report up about how some ransomware crew is using an old Gigabyte driver. So you load the driver and it's got a bug in it, so you own it and you use that to privesque. I mean, this is a technique we've seen a million times, but
yeah, it's smooth. Good job.
Yeah. But I mean, the one that I think is actually kind of cool this week, and I have no idea how effective it's going to be, but Emotet, we had Sherrod DeGrippo on the show recently talking about Emotet, but they've now got like a Wi-Fi spreader. So it's cool. Like what it does, once it takes over your system, it'll actually try attacking nearby Wi-Fi networks, brute forcing them using simple passwords. And then once it's on the network, trying to infect systems. So, you know, that's pretty cool that you can get owned by your next door neighbor's Emotet infection.
And the thing is, it'll work, right? I mean, it sounds dumb, but it will absolutely work, especially out in the burbs, you know, where there's all sorts of, you know, default telco routers. And especially if they've got a dictionary in there or they've got some way of guessing it that is, you know, has a bunch of like that kind of residential CPE device sets of credentials in it. And it would just, you know, it would go around in a, you know, dense suburb with lots of, you know, cable modems or whatever else.
Yeah, let alone places like South Korea where everybody's in, you know, fiber into the building and there's like, you know, a gazillion people in every building.
I think this is sounds like a pretty good innovation. Good job.
Yeah, let's see what happens. Also, a Dutch university got ransomware. They paid out $220,000. That news via Portswiggers news service. Well done there. What do we got here? Maze ransomware still going berserk. We've got advisories from French officials and the FBI. So yeah, look, ransomware crisis continues unabated. What else have we got here? Apple is deprecating kernel extensions in macOS, which is, you know, it's a good thing, but at the same time, it's kind of annoying for me because I use a bit of hardware that requires a kernel extension to work. So they're going to brick a whole bunch of stuff when they do this.
Yeah, I mean, this is unfortunately the trade-off, right? They want a more closed, more robust platform, and they're going to make you pay for it by virtue of bricking a whole bunch of stuff. And there's a lot of, you know, weird edge case video and audio and, you know, kind of other hardware where Apple was traditionally pretty dominant, you know, in broadcast and all that sort of thing, that is just going to get bricked, and Apple is just going to, you know, tough it.
Yeah, that's pretty much going to be my situation. I've lodged a ticket with the maker of one of my bits of hardware and just said, hello, what's your plan?
Can I have a userland driver, please? Because they're replacing it with a userland driver subsystem or something.
That's right, yeah, system extensions instead of kernel extensions, which seems like a better idea. Come on.
It is. It's totally a better idea. Yeah. But, you know.
Oh, man, and the hoops I had to jump through to get that kernel extension to work in the first place. Like, Apple doesn't make it easy. You know, you've got to do this and then reboot and then stand on, you know, your left foot with your right arm at a 45 degree angle and within 30 minutes enable this thing. And, you know, it's just
as
crazy.
As well, it should be difficult. So good job, Apple, making Pat's life difficult.
Thanks. what do we got here? Oh, we got some pretty epic Cisco bugs.
Oh, man.
the Cisco Discovery Protocol. Like, the more I read this one, the more my jaw was kind of hitting my desk.
This is such a beautiful set of bugs, man. I was so happy about this. So the set of research, I think it's from the same people who did the, like, embedded IP stack bugs from...
It's Armis, man. Invasions. They're the IoT people, right? And they've been pumping out the good stuff.
They certainly have. And this set of bugs is just, you know, like I'm making the chef kiss emoji. It's beautiful. They have bugs which in some cases are remote code execution via Cisco Discovery Protocol on Cisco Nexus stuff and Cisco iOS XR routers. And these are pretty big routers. This is the sort of thing in the case of Nexus, like that's the some of the, you know, really big data center gear, and the iOS XR is like, you know, telco and carrier grade routing and switching. If you're near one of those, near enough to talk CDP to them, then you probably already won a lot of cases. But like code exec via that, and both of these things are embedded Linux, I think, underneath, is like that gets you past so many other controls. And the one that really, the situation about that excites me is walking into an environment where you're, you know, on like the Cisco hyperconverged virtualization hardware with the Cisco Nexus switching behind you, you pop one VM in the DMZ, you pop the switch, and now you've, you know, you can hop VLANs, you can turn up anywhere in the network, and you're just like, they're completely wrecked. So I want that bug. Like, good. Similar bugs.
I mean, layer two, right? Like, this is just, you know, I mean, you it's bad.
I mean, you have to be close, right? Because of the layer two constraint, like you do need to be on the same segment.
But it propagates. That's the whole thing. So if it's an all Cisco environment,
Well, I mean, you'd have to do it yourself, right? It's not going to propagate magic.
Yeah, but you can hop around is my point, right?
But like, yes, if you're in an environment, that typically those environments are pretty homogenous in terms of the iOS, the Cisco hardware and the iOS versions. So yes, like once you pop one, you're going to be able to propagate around. And like, I'm super excited about those bugs and I can't wait to use them in the wild.
Yeah, because you get a feeling too that there's going to be a lot of stuff that doesn't get patched, right?
Oh yeah, like patching this stuff is not a fun process. And Cisco have always been kind of about providing patches to people who are outside of support, and it's just like it's going to be a long tail bug, and I like it.
Yeah,
the same set of research also had some bugs in Cisco IP phones via CDP. So there's plenty of environments where, you know, you pop up in someone's lobby and there's a, you know, Cisco IP phone on the wall, jump on that, shell another IP phone, next one over, and onwards and upwards into the management network, and who knows where you end up. Like these are real, like really good bugs, and they're dumb too. They're like memory corruption via like format strings or stack overflows, and of course because it's Cisco, like they're not compliant with stack cookies, right?
This there's no mitigations right in your embedded,
well there's ASLR, but it's 32-bit Linux ASLR where, you know, how much random do you really have, like about a byte's worth. It's classic Cisco, and a lot of people are going to get shelled by, you know, not ransomware crews, like the people who are using these bugs are going to be serious business.
You never know, though, man. Ransomware, there's a lot of money in it, right? And they're starting to get tricks, right? So I think that's a premature call. Let's just say that.
they may well, and especially if we take away all of the dumb things, like if we take away password spraying and we take away, you know, cred stuffing and we 2FA everything, then bugs like this are going to come back, right? They're going to come back big.
Yeah, they are. Some bugs have turned up in the WhatsApp desktop app, which is based on Electron. No surprises there. When I saw Brendan Scarville do his talk on the Electron bugs that he found a couple years back, when I looked at that, I'm just like, yeah, you can't fix this thing. This is...
No, I mean, Electron's garbage.
It is.
The impact of any bugs in that and the sorts of things that people don't have to worry about in the web environment, the impact of those is always terrible.
It's got profile of like Netscape 2. You know, like it's bad. F-Secure has fixed a heap overflow in its internet gatekeeper. Oh, God.
Whoopsie.
Yeah. But these are the AV bugs that we were kind of talking about lately. Just another bad one.
Yeah. And a great example of, you know, and this is like straight up memory corruption as well. Like it's a pretty retro sort of bug. Anything that's in a privileged position in the network, all the reasons why you would target internet security products and, you know, gateway devices like that. So,
but no biscuit. F-Secure does get a biscuit research post on forging Swift payment messages.
Oh, this is such a good post. We pasted around the office and everybody was digging into it and having a great time because it's just such a wonderful post about the guts of the Swift financial transfer network. And the article kind of walks through an engagement that they did at some point where they're operating in a payments environment and are trying to find ways to circumvent the controls around the Swift financial transfers, and they end up going through and kind of like getting to the point of being able to send successful international money transfers just by sticking the raw messages into the message queue and then having the rest of the, you know, pipeline that applies all the crypto and the macking and the security controls just process their like faked message that came in the message queue from the right place. And obviously there's a lot of very fine details that you need to understand to be able to do this kind of thing, and we haven't really seen, you know, traditional attackers who've been going after the payment systems, the Swift systems, doing it this way. Like normally they compromise the desktops of the people who are doing the transfers and just use the pointy clicky interface.
Yeah.
But this is just like sticking the messages on the bus. Like that is the way to do it. And I salute you, whoever you are.
Oliver Simonet.
Good job. Good job,
Oliver. And I mean,
and also like how much paperwork did he have to go through to be allowed to write that blog post? Like there must have been so many meetings and I
love the headline he stuck on it as well, which is forging Swift MT payment messages for fun and PR ... research, not for fun and profit. For fun and research.
Good job.
Microsoft has published an interesting blog post introducing security defaults.
Yeah, this is, I think, a pretty big deal, actually. This is them updating what are going to be the kind of default settings or the things that you can opt into when you sign up for, in this case, a Azure AD. They're bringing in a bunch of things that they've done in other areas of the Microsoft kind of identity ecosystem, which is going to, for example, require everyone to enroll in MFA right from the beginning and turn on a bunch of other really sensible controls that normally you would have to, you know, click through a whole bunch of stupid settings and use conditional access in Azure to kind of implement. This is going to make the kind of default posture of your average organization that signs up and just, you know, gets started with Azure without really thinking through or planning it well, which is most people. They're going to end up in a much, much stronger position. And I think it was also not 100% clear, but it did look like they are saying that they're going to make a bunch of the MFA features available across all of the licensing tiers, which has previously been kind of a sore point, you know, where people would, you know, buy the cheap Azure and then not get multi-factor, which is just not good enough. So if that's what it's saying, and it was a little bit, you know, it doesn't exactly say that in the press release, but it's kind of what it looked like. So if so, then good job, Microsoft, and it certainly made, I pasted it to our red team and they were sad. So that's always a good sign.
It is. Vice has a story up too about a guy who's selling, you know, wireless repeaters that let people steal cars, right? So you hold the receiver and then you've got a transmitter at the other end and you can sort of...
And does the like relay. Like,
yeah, it's just the relay attacks, relay, right? Yeah. But he's like, hey, I don't steal cars myself, so this is totally fine. The devices aren't illegal. He's going to have a bad time if authorities find him, like, because, yeah, people have been sent to prison for building traps in cars as well, right? Like stash holes. And yeah, so that's a bit funny. It's interesting that this story actually quotes Sami Kamkar, because I know that Sami actually had implemented versions of this attack like years ago and conspicuously never really published much about it, right? Because I don't think it's something that has an easy solution. So yeah, car theft could be much more popular again sometime soon, like way back to the 90s. What do we got? Google fixed a zero user interaction bug in Bluetooth for Android, but sort of old versions.
Ooh, yeah,
this is pre-10, but yeah, it looked like a pretty reasonable bug.
It's a pretty banging looking bug. The details are not out specifically. You have to go reverse some patches or wait for the talk from, I think it was the researchers from ENRW that came up with it. But like a bug like that, zero interaction via Bluetooth, even when it's, you know, it was Android 9 and earlier, like that's a bug that's going to have a long tail. Like if it's code exec, and it looked like it was, then... You know, I want that bug. Like, I
mean, yeah, there's a few. Yeah. Oh, we're not really going to have time to talk about it this week, but Patch Tuesday just dropped and it looks like there's some clangers in there, like maybe another RDP bug. There's another one that says, like, if you send an email to Exchange, you can exploit this condition, which looks like RCE, right? It's a bad one. No details yet, but it's bad.
It's really hard actually parsing the Microsoft advisories these days about to try and get a good sense of what they're really saying. But yeah, there's RDS bug, there's a Exchange bug, there's a bunch of, you know, Windows local stuff as well. There's something that looks like a Kerberos cross forest ticket forgery bug, which apply your patch Tuesday. There's lots of things you really want to patch.
Oh, just one more post from the Daily Swig, which is PortSwigger's news service worth mentioning, which is SIMTCP. Packet fragmentation stuff isn't new, right, to avoid deep packet inspection. But this looks like some new research there, which helps you to sort of really nail down how to do it against different types of equipment, including the Great Firewall of China. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, this is some cool research into like building a symbolic execution engine for the TCP stack so that you can find that kind of, you know, what traditionally we would have done with FragRouter, where you've got canonicalization bugs between two different IP stacks where the end system parses it differently to the you know, IDS or the packet inspector that's in the middle of the network, building something that's dropped by one and allowed by the other. And this is, yeah, using symbolic execution to compare two TCP stacks, which... is a really cool kind of piece of research. I mean, the class of bugs isn't new, but I mean, novel variants of it are genuinely useful.
Yeah, I mean, previously though, you'd just try a few different sort of types of fragmentation and see what sticks, but this is like doing it the smarter way.
This is doing it the kind of the academic way. And the code's on GitHub, it seems pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's one to check out. Now, I've linked through also in this week's show notes to some of the transcripts from Joshua Schulte's trial, and oh boy, they're full of all sorts of goodies, like about what happens on the CIA Devlan and like their process for like, well, you know, they need to own this sort of device. So we buy it, we plug it in, this, that. So there's some great testimony in there and it'll just get you, you know, it's a fun read anyway, a long read, but all of those transcripts are becoming available day by day. And that brings us to a bit of a discussion, Adam, that we've got to have. Bit of a discussion, but I've made I've made a musical intro for this discussion and I'm going to play it now.
Now we're through the looking glass here, people. White is black and black is white.
Pepe Sylvia, this name keeps coming up over and over again. Every day Pepe's mail's getting sent back to me. Pepe Sylvia, Pepe Sylvia. I look in the mail, well, this whole box is Pepe Sylvia.
There
is no Pepe Sylvia. The man does not exist, okay? So I decided, oh, shit, buddy, I gotta dig a little deeper. There's no Pepe Sylvia, you gotta be kidding me. I got boxes full of Pepe. All right, so I start marching my way down to Carol and HR. Hey, when I open the door, what do I find? There's not a single goddamn desk in that office. There is no Carol in HR.
So yeah, last week I floated a bit of a strange theory that Joshua Schulte, who is the alleged CIA Vault 7 leaker, could be behind the Shadow Brokers leaks as well. The thing is, we didn't really have a timeline for Schulte's activity until he was charged and brought to court, and now we do. And that timeline matches up pretty damn closely with the Shadow Brokers' activity. We used to think Vault 7 happened after the Shadow Brokers, but it actually happened before, right? So that's what really blew my mind last week. And Schulte's alleged activity also matches up with a bunch of other key events from 2016, and I'll get to that in a moment. So look, it was a compelling enough timeline match for me to spend a lot of the last week really digging into this, and here is where I've landed. I don't think Joshua Schulte was the Shadow Brokers, but I still can't definitely rule him out as being connected to it, either directly or indirectly. So there's a couple of things that strongly suggest it isn't him. First up, although he was an exploit dev in the intelligence community, obviously he was working for the wrong agency, the CIA, not NSA. So it would have been difficult for Schulte to obtain that material, which is thought to be the Shadow Brokers material, which is thought to be an NSA ops disk, which dates back to 2013. Not impossible that he would have got it, but certainly difficult. The second thing is he was in detention when one Shadow Brokers post appeared. And that's the one that appeared on September 6th, 2017. And still, that could have been a scripted or a timed post. It's a Steemit post, which means you commit the post to a blockchain and it appears. So it's basically one of the only content platforms where you could schedule a post and authorities would be powerless to stop it because they wouldn't know what the ingress point to the blockchain is, right? There's also a link in that post to a mega archive that was created the day of the post. But again, that could have been scripted and was indeed created at the top of an hour. So we don't know whether this was a scheduled drop or not. But the thing that swung me away from Schulte most is more the inside baseball nature of the Shadow Brokers posts. References to Q Group investigations, bitching about various ex-NSA employees, and taking swings at dark matter. Indeed, one of the Shadow Brokers leaks looks purpose-built to damage the relationship between Dubai and the USA. So Shadow Brokers really doesn't like the UAE's coziness with the United States. Now, look, one thing I've said a lot over the last week while looking into this is the more I research this, the less I know. So let me just explain that a little. I'd always thought and operated under the assumption that Shadow Brokers was a Russian op. But now I'm really not so sure. Before Schulte popped up, I didn't really have any idea in my head of what an intelligence community leaker like this looks like. And now we do, you know? And it's really changed my perspective on what's possible. But it was diving into the timeline that actually started making me go a little bit nuts, because the timeline in 2016 is a frenzy of activity involving Russia's GRU, WikiLeaks, and Joshua Schulte. Between April and August 2016, the DNC, NSA, and CIA all had very sensitive information extracted from them and either given to WikiLeaks or subsequently released publicly. So let's run through some hypothetical scenarios here, which are all maddeningly and frustratingly plausible. Theory number one, Joshua Schulte somehow had access to NSA information as well as CIA information. He was the so-called second source back in 2013, and he is the Shadow Brokers. WikiLeaks had been handling him for years. He is also the Loch Ness Monster. Theory two, Russia is behind everything. They stole the material from the DNC, they worked with WikiLeaks to get Schulte to walk info out of the building, and they had a hand in Shadow Brokers somehow. They burned the DNC and then crippled the IC response. The timeline of activity looks coordinated, and who better to coordinate it? So, in summary, theory two, Russia. Theory three, and I like this one, Shadow Brokers is a NSA insider who burned the agency's 2013 ops disk because they discovered it was compromised. Maybe someone took the disk with them to their new job for like dark matter or something, and the person behind the Shadow Brokers just thought, you know what, f*** this. hence the Dubai Swift leaks and burning those exploits. Shadow Broker's post just dripping in anger directed towards former NSA staff, particularly those who went to work for other countries. Maybe they found out this ops disk was circulating and they decided to burn the tools in some sort of weird patriotic protest. Theory four. Shades of all of the above. And that's the thing, we don't know. Shadow Brokers could have been a disgruntled insider who was still knowingly or unknowingly working for a foreign intelligence service. This whole thing could literally be a blend of everything that I've just laid out. But what we do have, what we can say, and this is the important part really that I've learned over the last week, what we do have is too many coincidences in 2016. There was too much stuff happening all at once, so some of it has to be connected. It can't all be a coincidence, but of course, some of it could be. To be honest, I will be surprised if the FBI makes a Shadow Brokers-related arrest. The info that they dropped was 3 years old already when they leaked it, so it was basically a cold case from the get-go, so we might never know. But yes, certainly I am leaning more towards a pissed-off NSA guy over Hal Martin and Nia Pho having their home networks popped by Russia. So look, you know, this is the first time I've really thrown a solid block of time at this since we've had more information to sift through. And I do feel like I led listeners up the garden path a bit last week. So sorry about that, everyone. But Adam, I also happened to drag you into this rabbit hole through the last week or so. And what do you think of all of this?
Oh, I think maybe you need a lie down.
Nita Beckson, a good lie down. Yes.
Yeah. It's weird, right? The coincidences are weird. And I mean, like one of the example bits that you, I mean, well, I guess I've had a bunch of, you know, like a flurry of messages from you, you know, as you've gone through this process of, you know, finding new and exciting things and then disproving them and then extra and onwards and onwards. Honestly, I have no idea. It makes no sense, but it does. It makes so much sense, which is the thing that's,
that's the thing.
Yeah.
But do you agree with me when you look at this? It certainly appears coordinated, a lot of the stuff that happened in 2016.
Well, yeah. I mean, the timeline is by far the most compelling. And until we found that, you know, that one particular post where he was in jail or he was in whatever it was, he was on bail or something.
No, he was in jail. He was in jail and then made bail afterwards. And that's when there was another post that actually demonstrated currency by referring to a recent article, whereas the September post doesn't do that, which is why it could be scripted. Why demonstrate currency in October but not in September? Who knows? But I still don't think it's him.
It's a good question, eh? And I mean, the bit that you dragged me into was we looked at the dump that he posted on Mega, and there's a bunch of GPG signatures, and the signing times on those signatures is 6 months prior.
I think that's meaningless, though. I don't think we can really. I don't know that we can really learn much from that, but it is still interesting.
There's just a whole bunch of weird stuff in that timeline, I'm telling you. But no, I'm not. I've been trying to, you know, remain impartial and listen to your theories. And honestly, who? I mean, is it Russia? I mean, the disgruntled NSA insider who just decides it's not worth going through the paperwork to try and deal with the fact that stuff that's been transferred to Dark Matter. Honestly, that rings quite. I mean, I like that theory better than Russia because, I mean, Russia is such a nebulous boogeyman for everything, whereas, you know, office politics are too difficult. Let's just go and burn and vent some, you know, vent some anger on the internet. That kind of seems believable.
Did I manage to get some of my crazy on you?
You did get a little bit on. I mean, I largely tried to wipe it off, but, you know, it's catching.
It is catching. Well, mate, that concludes our discussion about 2016 madness. Adam Boileau, thank you so much for joining us on the show, as always, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat. Hopefully next week it's a little less nuts.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. A very quick announcement now. Risky Business has made a hire. Brett Winterford, who at one point was actually the editor of itnews.com.au here in Australia, he will be coming on board in March. He's going to be focusing on producing written content for the Risky Biz website. There's going to be a weekly digest that will be pretty comprehensive. We don't think there's anything like what we're planning out there already. And the funny thing about Brett, right, is he's a technology journalist by background, but he left the media industry about 5 years ago to take a security job at the Commonwealth Bank here in Australia. And he stayed there for a few years before joining Symantec. And now he's with us. So that's awesome. I'll be keeping you all updated with what we're doing in coming weeks because, yeah, I think he starts week of March 9. So that's pretty exciting stuff. And that is made possible by the Hewlett Foundation, who've given us a grant so that we can actually do this type of content that isn't solely built to be monetized, if that makes sense. So yeah, we're all pretty pumped about it. And yeah, more news on that coming soon. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Richard Baitlick of Corelight. Corelight, as I'm sure most of you know, they make a network sensor. They don't make a pane of glass. They make a sensor. It's based on the open source software Zeek, formerly known as Bro, and the commercial version lets you do better tuning and stuff like that, and it's just more suited to enterprise use. But fundamentally, the thing it's based on is an open source tool, and Richard is looking to bolster the open source community behind that tool. Corelight has devs working on Zeek and now has a community manager as well, and they're working on a few things right now to get all that moving. And Richard, join me to talk through all of that. As you'll hear, there are a bunch of serious business companies that are standardizing on Zeek for network monitoring. And I started off by asking Richard, who actually contributes to Zeek? And here's what he had to say.
We see a mix. You see, so for example, Salesforce, and I'm not going to talk about like specific customers, but I'll just give you an example of some of the top contributors that come to mind. So Salesforce comes to mind because they have decided that they're making Zeek, the programming language, their standard for network security monitoring. And as a result, when they code up or when they're trying to develop a new capability, they look towards Zeek first. So that's why you see projects like JE3 coming from, or Hash or whatever coming from Salesforce. Amazon is another example. They decided that they were standardizing on Zeek as their network security monitoring platform. So they needed some protocol parsers to handle a few protocols that weren't in the current setup. So they wrote those, used them internally, and then released them to the open source community. And that's something we're trying to encourage, just as the Zeek open source project team, that if you come up with something interesting, feel free to share it. Because what you'll see, for example, is that someone will release code, someone else will take a look at it and say, that's really cool. Have you thought about this? Or if I make this change, it's more efficient. Or, oh, there's a problem with what you originally released. You're missing this part of it. Let me make a change.
Yeah, so there's something to be gained by actually throwing it out there into a community that's going to scrutinize it a bit, I think is what you're getting at there.
Yeah, that is really, I think, the power of open source. It isn't that you've got thousands of people looking at it. It may simply be that you get one or two, but they're the right set of eyes to discover something that you hadn't thought of.
We had a chat with another network monitoring vendor recently, and they were getting pretty excited about, you know, like last year, Microsoft Azure, you know, they enabled these sort of network tap interfaces in cloud infrastructure. And that's been a long time coming, right? And I think Amazon's got the same thing now. So you know, is that a big thing for you as well? I'd imagine that would help with this push to standardization, you know, if you're sort of cloud friendly, right?
It is. It's interesting from a couple of different perspectives. One is that we've recognized that customers have an analysis pipeline, a set of tools, processes, people that they're comfortable with. And when you introduce a different data set into that that doesn't match what they're already used to, there's a certain amount of friction that results. So when you can say, I want to be able to get some type of network visibility out of my cloud infrastructure, and I can get that by using a virtual tap, and then I attach to that virtual tap the very same kinds of tools that I use in my enterprise, suddenly you've got data coming out that is at least familiar in the right format. It's got the right schema. You can put it into the same storage tools, analysis platforms. People know what it looks like. That's, I think, one of the biggest reasons people like it. And a second reason is that, and this is something that I've only just learned in the last year or so, is that while the cloud vendors provide a certain amount of logging, and I'm grateful for all the logging they provide and the analysis platforms and such, in some cases, it's just not high fidelity enough. It doesn't contain exactly what you're looking for.
And even in the cases where it is high fidelity enough, it sort of requires the developers to, you know, invoke it within their applications and stuff. And like, it's just very complicated. And I think there was this expectation. This is something we've talked about on the show before. I think there was an expectation from the platforms that people would create, you know, next generation tooling that would make good use of their native logging, you know, APIs. And that tooling just sort of never materialized, right? So they finally capitulated and said, fine, here's your virtual network taps. And, you know, as a result, all of the network monitoring companies are very, very happy.
Yeah. Yeah. And another aspect is that the native logging can be late. It can be late by minutes, tens of minutes, in some cases an hour or more. Now, it takes a pretty high-end team to make good use of real-time, you know, or pseudo real-time logging, near real-time logging. But for the customer set who is interested in being able to see what's happening right away, I don't want to wait until you write that log eventually, you know, cloud provider. So having your own tools and all that, you sort of avoid that process.
Now, we were speaking before we started recording the interview, and it was funny because you used this term, ground truth, right? The network as a source of ground truth information. And that's really funny because I've heard that from two other vendors that we deal with that sponsor this program who both do networking stuff. And I mentioned that to you and you were surprised because you're like, oh, I sort of thought that was me coming up with that independently. But it is really, this is the new thing, isn't it? And the example you used was this, you know, this whole Jeff Bezos, you know, hacked iPhone fiasco is ultimately, if you've got access to good network information about that device, whether that's, you know, combining cellular logs, you know, cellular network logs with, you know, Wi-Fi network logs, you're able to get that ground truth, aren't you? Even if you have no visibility into what's happening in the device at a forensic level, the network data is still going to tell you a fair bit.
Oh, yeah. And I learned that in the 90s from my mentors in the Air Force. And so I've probably written about it and then forgotten, and now I'm coming back to it again. And there's so many benefits to monitoring the network that, you know, periodically different ones come in and out of vogue. But yeah, when I read the forensic report on the Bezos, we'll call it incident, because I don't necessarily know that it's a hack. And there's been people like Robert Graham who have said, I don't think the phone was hacked. It occurred to me that one of the ways you might have been able to find out if this were true or not would be to take a look at any sort of network security monitoring data that might be present. You know, for example, I'm sure Bezos spends a lot of his time on an Amazon campus. And if he spends time on that campus, his phone is probably getting its connectivity via Wi-Fi. And the Wi-Fi is probably going out through some enterprise gateway that could be monitored. If he's at home, I would instrument that guy's home network. I wouldn't just let him rely on his commercial Fios line.
Yeah, you don't
whatever.
Want him using a $50 D-Link device, right? Yeah. Like if you're a billionaire, maybe like, you know, kind of get that one plugged into the sock.
Yeah, exactly. So that leaves when he would just be roaming around going on whatever Wi-Fi or whatever cellular data he uses. And of course, that's sort of the big, ooh, gotcha, the bad guys will just do everything while you're on cell and you don't have any sort of end, you know, close to the device monitoring possible. But then again, I read recently of malware that checks to see if the user is on Wi-Fi because they figure it's easier to exfil data on Wi-Fi than it is to do it when you're on cellular.
Well, I think the solution clearly for Jeff Bezos is to buy a telco.
Well, yeah.
He can just buy his own national LTE network. Problem solved.
Yeah, well, there's several for sale, I suppose. Given that he decided to build his own competitor to FedEx and UPS, he could possibly build one and use.
Yeah, just build a telco, and then he can log the crap out of it. Right? That'd be fine. So, look, just going back to the open source stuff, I understand you've been doing a bit of work on the project website and trying to just sort of get some renewed interest in that community or boost interest in that community. What sort of contributors are you looking for at the moment?
So as far as the Zeek project goes, we're interested in all sorts of contributors. You do not have to be a C++ developer who can write in the Zeek programming language or whatever. You will probably see in the next few days, or I think at the next community call we have. And by the way, we have we actually have an employee who works at CoreLight named Amber, whose job is as the Zeek community manager. So just like SourceFire used to, or I guess they still do, pay for a Snort community manager, we have one for Zeek. And so she's been organizing Ask the Expert calls and webinars and community calls. So you'll be hearing this sort of stuff coming out on the website and blog and those sorts of calls. But just for an example, working on the website, we'd like to go through all of the blog posts that have been posted over the years and make sure they're properly formatted, make sure that they're tagged so that someone who's new to the project can find something easy. And that only requires being able to read English language blog posts.
You don't so this have is all bread and butter community stuff, right? Which is like, you know, making it easier, I guess. And this is the thing, isn't it? You're switching from more of a traditionally passively managed community to more of a, okay, you know, we've got a dedicated community manager. We're going to do some decent content curation so people can find interesting stuff, you know, have those calls, have those sessions. So I guess that's the change, is it that it's, you're switching into that actively managed community.
Yeah. Yeah. Like for example, we had the first Zeek Week last fall, and that was a follow on from the BroCons that's been renamed. And so we're having more training associated with that. The idea is to get more people aware of the project, understanding what the software can do, at the very least using the software. You don't have to be a contributor. You simply just trying it out is very, very helpful. It helps you. You know, more users is always good for the project. And then the ultimate goal would be to have some percentage of those people start to contribute back, whether it's in the form of documentation or testing or coding or even just describing the use cases that they're trying to solve for. All of that is welcome.
All right. Well, Richard Baitlick, thank you so much for joining us on the show. It's always a pleasure to chat to you, and best of luck with, you know, building this community out a little bit more and making it a more approachable and a more fun place to be. I wish you, all the best of luck with it.
Good deal. Thanks, Patrick. And I would tell people if they want to learn more to go to Zeek.org, you know, Zeek.org. And or if you want simply want to wait a few weeks, or I'm not quite sure exactly when we'll relaunch the website, be sure to continue checking it out to see the new site when we launch it.
That was Richard Baitlick there with a chat about Zeek and its open source community. Do check out CoreLite at corelite.com. If you want to add some network data to your SIEM, this is a good way to do it. So do check them out. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back tomorrow with a Soapbox edition of the podcast. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.